good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, recently returned from our great adventure in Manhattan at the James Beard Awards.
Assorted rainstorms.
It rained for the entire time we were in New York.
And crowds of people, but we still had a wonderful time.
Yeah, it was good. It was, it was this funny coincidence that happens every year, which is the James Beard Foundation Awards and the big Metropolitan Fashion. Then what's it called?
I don't know. It's a big fancy dress ball, and everybody got all dressed up, and
what I was about to say is it seemed like the whole city was just, at least Midtown, was just blowing away with the most fancy clothes imaginable.
and they were all at an after party of Bob Ballou.
Yes.
as guests of Daniel Ballou, and we were there till we escaped and went somewhere else. But that's another story, and perhaps we won't even get to that story, because the most important things in the culinary calendar for the year, if you're interested in who's considered the best, were happening at the Aubrey Fisher Hall at Lincoln Center, and of course On the Menu was there. We had our trusty recording equipment set up in the press room, and you can tell from the background of some of the interviews you're going to hear that it was a very noisy place, but it was a fun place too. Everybody was having a wonderful time. The winners were really excited. To start off our coverage of the evening...
Well, to start off, I need to say that I feel really bad that I missed. I was sitting in the press room, and I missed Richard Gere. His wife was presenting,
and Richard Gere
was right outside of the press room, and I missed him.
Well, never mind. You have to put up with another handsome white-haired gentleman who's more available to you. And listeners, you can guess who that is. But to set the stage for the entire evening, it was fun to catch up with Emily Lucchetti, who was involved in organizing all the chefs for the program, Lydia Bastianich, who was the official chair of the event, and luminary Joyce Goldstein. And we didn't even get involved in that conversation. We said, Lydia, why don't you take it away? So here she is, Lydia Bastianich and friends.
How exciting. This is Lydia Bastianich, and we are backstage from the big event of the evening, and that is the James Beard Awards, the great event. But what's so special about tonight? It's all women.
Yeah.
And with me I have Lucchetti and Joyce Goldstein, and great chefs, pastry chef.
Pastry chefs, chefs, winemakers, mixologists. We've really brought together
women,
all
the
cheesemakers,
every area of food where women have been involved, they're represented this evening. And it's really quite an event, because we've never had an event at the Beard Awards that were all women.
Yeah.
So we're very proud of them. It's quite something.
And Emily, you are in charge of the awards.
I'm in charge of the awards committee, and the awards committee actually picked the theme this year. And we really wanted to celebrate women, and it isn't that women are having a hard time, it's just that they're doing so well, and that they're doing such different things and unique things and such fabulous things that we really wanted to celebrate them. We actually did an event in 1992, but it was way in the early days of Beard. And then it was hard to get women, you know, to find enough women. Now we had so many women to pick from. We could do this theme every year.
Absolutely. It is so wonderful. You know, just to see them all in the kitchen and how efficiently, how everything. Yeah. I mean, I don't differentiate in gender. I really don't. Once you're in the kitchen, you are a professional.
Right.
But we can't help be excited that it's all women.
All women.
Well,
yeah.
Also because women run a kitchen in a very collaborative way. It's a little less hierarchical. It's a little more embracing of everybody. And I think it sets a beautiful tone in the kitchen, which has been often run like an army station. So it's sort of a nice change.
Okay. Yeah. Well, Joyce, Joyce Goldstein has been, tell me, Joyce, you had a big input on the choice of the women chefs that were going to be here tonight.
Yes, we wanted chefs from all over the country. So from Seattle, we have Maria Hines. From Los Angeles, we have Suzanne Track. From Chicago, Carrie Nahabedian. We have Michelle Bernstein from Florida. We try to get people from all over, because women are now everywhere.
Yeah. And we also wanted a good range of women. And we wanted some newer faces and fresh faces and people that were just starting out to establish themselves. We also wanted people, the old guard, been around for long and are still in their kitchens doing amazing, wonderful food.
You know, Emily, I have my pastry chef from Kansas City, Danica.
Monica's
yes,
coming.
And she is in her early 20s. And I can't tell you how excited she is. I mean, this is, she said, oh, I can't thank you enough. This is an opportunity of a lifetime. Not only to be here, to be at the event, but to meet all of their sort of contemporaries.
Yeah. I think to cook with your peers in a situation like this is really inspiring. When you meet people who have been doing it a long time, and then you meet people who are just starting out from small restaurants in the country, Andrea Rusing, I mean, Jennifer Coco in Utah. We were thrilled to find people out
there. Out there in what we would, the people on the coast would call the hinterland.
So how about food? What do you see? What was, are we going to have a diversity, a seasonality, or what?
Definitely seasonal. Definitely diverse. A lot of things will be at room temperature because women are eminently practical. And they're not trying to do the impossible. They won't be super fancy.
You're
going to
serve 1,600 people. You want to make it easy and you got to be smart about it.
But they're smart. They're smart.
Well, I think we're getting all nervous here
all
because
we're
the time is coming.
The gong has sounded.
Thank
so thanks.
You.
Thanks.
Well, we're going to come back and talk about all the wonderful food after we've had it as well. So I love being around you ladies again. Thanks for coming on our program.
Our pleasure to be here. We'll talk food later.
Exactly.
Ciao.
Thanks, Lydia. Thanks, Emily.
For those of you who just sort of haven't registered that this, the James Beard Foundation Annual Awards is referred to as the Oscars of the food world.
And it has one interesting thing in common also, in that it tends to run, the program tends to run longer than anybody ever expected, and this year broke a record.
Oh, that was long.
But there were, we caught up with three very, very excited winners. Some of the other winners we couldn't get, but these were so excited. These guys were so excited, and the shortest interview on record with on the menu is Michael Latta of a restaurant called Fig in Charleston, South Carolina.
We'll start with Nate. Nate's coming up next.
Oh, he is?
Nate's next.
Okay, well, we're just going to run them together. So included in it will be Nate Appleman, who was rising star chef for a fabulous restaurant called A16 in San Francisco, California, where we'll be going soon. And he didn't have a whole lot to say, but he sure sounded excited. Michael Latta, as I mentioned already, from Fig Restaurant, who was best chef Southeast. And there's a special note that you'll catch when you get to him.
And then
a rather more laid back winner, John Currents from City Grocery in Oxford, Mississippi. So you'll be interested in the excitement and the suavité all together in one segment of the program. So we're going to put them back to back.
Want to talk?
This is the greatest accomplishment that, you know, professionally that I've ever had. Going up there, my whole body was tingling. My fingers were numb, and I've never had an overwhelming feeling like that before. So this is incredible.
Oh, God, you've worked so hard for it. Nate Appleman, congratulations.
Thank you.
Rising star, we already knew that. Thanks. We'll see you in a week or so.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks. Yeah, well, Peter says that the results of the best chef Southeast proves that there is indeed a God, and we are so grateful that you won, Mike Latta. Congratulations. You said you've never felt like that.
Yeah, and I'm beside myself, to be honest with you. I really, my competition not only is steep, but they're gentlemen. They're wonderful chefs, beautiful people.
Yeah.
And the fact that I won, I'm so honored to be in that position.
Well, your restaurant, Fig, food is good, is fabulous. You are fabulous, and I've been rooting for you for a long time. So let's have a kiss.
I know you have, and I appreciate that. You guys have been so good to me over the years. And I can't
I
tell
it.
You how much.
And your wife is happy,
that.
Too.
So who did you call first?
What's that?
Who did you call first? Your wife's here.
I got about 10 or 12 texts from my employees and my friends. I haven't called anybody yet, actually. I'm caught up. My business partner's here, my girlfriend's here, and we've celebrated, you know, on a small level. But soon enough, we'll share the joy.
But your tweets are already coming in. Everybody's happy.
Well, like crazy, yeah.
Well, you enjoy it.
Thanks
I'll
so
see
much.
You later on. Are you going to an after party?
I'm sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks so much,
Thanks
Mike.
So much.
Bye.
John Currents and Peter Haig have never met.
but that's not important to me. But the reason I'm talking to John tonight is he just had a big night.
Unbelievable night. I mean, it's one of those that sort of, I guess life has led up to this sort of unknowingly, I suppose.
Okay, so explain why that is.
Well, we are the recipient of the 2009 Best Chef South Award from the James Beard Foundation.
And your restaurant's called?
My restaurant's called City Grocery. We actually have four in Oxford, Mississippi. City Grocery, Bouret, Big Bad Breakfast, and Snack Bar are all there in Oxford. About a stone's throw from one another, or Driver Nine Iron, as some call it.
But you won for one particular restaurant?
We won for City Grocery, yes, sir.
And it's probably a little bit more sophisticated a restaurant than the name City Grocery would imply.
It is. When we opened, I was searching for a name that wasn't going to pin us down to any one particular ethnic theme or sort of one sort of mindset for the folks that would come and visit us. And the building was actually, prior to it being a restaurant, had housed the City Grocery, and it just seemed perfect. It didn't imply anything.
Now, you don't sound like a Southerner.
Well, I've had the opportunity to live all over the world, so I'm from New Orleans originally. And
oh, okay, so you're Southerner at heart.
Well, and the weird thing is that New Orleanians don't consider themselves Southerners. It's a very strange thing.
No, they consider themselves New Orleanites. Right?
Yeah, they're just sort of sophisticates in the island that New Orleans is in the Deep South. But I've been in Oxford, Mississippi for the last 17 years, and I've learned a tremendous amount about being a Southerner and about the food that I grew up and how proud I need to be of it. So.
Now, say a word to our listeners about Oxford, Mississippi, because I know it's the home of the University of Mississippi, and John Edge from the Southern Food something is there.
Southern Foodways
but
Alliance.
It's not exactly on most people's food map.
It's not, but I think the combination of our having settled in Oxford and opened seven restaurants in the last 17 years, and the Southern Foodways Alliance,
that's John Edge, right?
Correct. Becoming as entrenched in Oxford and in Oxford culture and Oxford's identity as it has, Oxford has become a sort of weirdly a sort of small food destination for folks.
Well, that must be pretty thrilling. Now, give us just a snapshot of City Grill. For our listeners who are thinking about it, I mean, what if you went to City Grill, what might you eat?
Well, you're going to get a little bit of everything. Again, I started City Grocery in 92, and I really had no business going into the to opening my first restaurant by any means. And so I intentionally created a menu that was not beyond my abilities, and I had the opportunity to grow up with it. And so we touch on a number of different cuisines, primarily French and Creole, New Orleans Creole French, but it's all very much intertwined with the ingredients and the dishes of the Deep South. We do a tremendous amount of local ingredient in the dishes.
So if we're next time we're in New Orleans, we should make a detour or we should make a stop along the way.
I'd say absolutely, particularly now it seems like.
Well, John, I know you have to go off and celebrate. Thank you so much for joining us, John Carnes from City Grocery in Oxford, Mississippi. Congratulations once again, and thank you for talking to us on the menu.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure visiting with you.
Well, you know, you can tell it's very festive, but we picked people out of the crowd to get them to say something, and we spotted one of our favorite people, and I just realized for the first time that I've gone through all these years mispronouncing her name. I called her Betty Fussell, and in fact, it is Fussell rhyming with Russell. We got her to say a few words, and then we had the editor of Bon Appetit magazine, Barbara Fairchild. So let's listen to them. Well, we have this wonderful opportunity to talk to who I view as the Wonder Woman of the culinary field, Betty Fussell. Betty, you were at the awards in three different, wearing three different hats. Tell us what you're doing tonight.
Tonight, my three-hat luck is to first be a nominee for a book award in the literary category, and my book is Raising Stakes, And unfortunately, my competitors are guys like Michael Pollan. And my second hat is a great honor for me to be an inductee in the foundation's Who's Who.
Well deserved, yes,
well,
indeed.
Thank you so much. And my third hat is to be a presenter of Jane Grigson for the Cookbook Hall of Fame. That's the real thrill
and
for me.
And she's wonderful,
she's
too. Now, about your book, Raising Steak, tell us a little bit about it. I know something about that, but tell our listeners about it.
Yes. Well, it's subtitled The Life and Times of American Beef.
See, I thought it was an odd thing. I mean, I was surprised that you wrote it, actually.
Well, it's a natural sequence to the story of corn, which I wrote about earlier.
Right.
Because it's an American icon. Beef steak. Steak is much more American than apple pie.
You know? I agree.
And it has its own, for reasons that are us. It has the cowboys, the myth. It has so much romance. The romance of the West, all of that is embedded in steak. At the same time, it's contradicted by the way in which we have industrialized everything. So I like the dramatic tension between one kind of cowboy myth and industrial reality.
Well, I mean, it's going to be a tight race for this book award, I know. You have a long history with the Beard Foundation. This seems to be a pivotal year. I don't know why I feel that, but do you feel that?
Absolutely, I do.
I think
enough time has passed. We're also in the middle of economic hard times. We look for things to celebrate and ways to celebrate.
It.
When things are tough, you go immediately to food because that's the common bond of all of us. You get rid of a lot of falderol. You get back to elemental things.
And so that's it.
And
Andy,
this is what James Beard was about, and I'm just thrilled. I mean, I'm sure he's around looking at us and saying, yeah, I told you all this 30 years ago.
Well, you are a divine, lovely lady, and thank you so much for talking to us. Good luck.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks. Bye. Barbara Fairchild. Of course, everybody who's listening probably reads your magazine, Bon Appetit, every single month.
Thank you.
You're editor-in-chief. And I never realized till tonight that you had actually worked your way from the very bottom of the rung all the way up.
Exactly. Thank you very much. Yes, it's kind of a rare story in our business, but most people move around a lot, but I've managed to hang on all this time and started at the bottom as an editorial assistant, and I've been editor-in-chief now for the past 9 years.
I mean, you're holding sway over a world that is dramatically different today in the publishing, in journalism, everything.
In everything, in food and restaurants, everything that involves our world, wines, travel, kitchens. It's really an incredible journey, all that we've learned and the things that we still have to learn.
The lady from Fat One.
You know this book, Fat.
Yes, that's a fantastic book. I'm very happy about that.
Bones is also good. Yeah, she's fabulous.
She's great.
Well, anyhow, listeners, we're being distracted here, but Barbara knows so much, because she's pursued this whole, or followed this whole history of development of the culinary interest in this country as well.
Yes, it's been really fascinating to see really the evolution of supermarkets, farmers markets, how television has really put food on the map and made it become a part of the cultural conversation, as well as certainly the internet. I mean, that's changed the way we cook and eat and research and do everything. I mean, you can find anything on the internet that you want to cook with in your kitchen. You can find out information about restaurants and menus and people and places. It's really revolutionized how we live.
Well, you've sort of integrated this into how you keep your fingers on the pulse of America.
Well, thank you. We have a fantastic website of our own at bonappetit.com. A lot of fat here tonight. Big fat duck and now the fat cookbook. But we have a great website at bonappetit.com that really compliments what we do in the magazine and is a lot of fun. I'm very proud of that too.
And you keep how do you keep publishing all these cookbooks? This latest one of the Fresh Fat.
The Fast Easy Fresh. I have a great team. They're very dedicated.
It's a wonderful book.
Thank you. I have to say, I'm very proud of the work that we did on that book. It's fantastic to cook from. I cooked like crazy out of it over the holidays, and I was very happy with the results.
Oh, yes. And now, tell us about just some comments about how you think this has gone. This is probably one of the liveliest Beard Awards I've ever been to.
You know, it's interesting. Since the Beard Awards were moved here to Lincoln Center,
yes,
I think they've taken on a whole new look and feel. It's become much more important and impressive in this kind of a setting.
I just want to do a real-time intersperse here. Heston Blumenthal's Great Fat Duck Cookbook just won for photography.
Okay,
guess who accepted the award?
Who?
Thomas Keller.
Oh, that's great.
That's a great moment.
Isn't that a great moment?
That's a great moment.
Oh, yeah. Well, they're all so wonderful. I mean, this is what makes our job so interesting, all the people who are very interesting.
Well, you know, it's funny. I think when the Beard Awards first debuted, there were a lot of people who really didn't take them seriously, but I think now all of the people who have become celebrities in the world of food have made these awards just as important as any other award in entertainment and in culture.
Well, I mean, and you're really at the center of all of it, Barbara. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
I still remember when you stood up for restaurant critics when I was a restaurant critic.
Oh, well, thank you.
At that seminar.
Very nice of you.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
And now I think we'll take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu. Remember, email us at any time, onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com. Look for OTM Dish on Twitter. That's me. And you can tweet with me, which everybody at the Beard event was doing. That was probably the most different and distinctive aspect of the show. People, half the audience had the Blackberries going, and as soon as the awards were announced, they were all over the globe. It was just amazing. Also, incidental notes were being passed back and forth. Some of them I wouldn't even repeat.
many of them were really quite unrepeatable. And I
must say we did not capture all the winners. As you could see, it was very lively and catch-as-catch-can. And so a lot of them, like Best Chef in the country, Dan Barber, Jean-Georges Von Gerichten, who was Best Restaurant.
They were so late in the parade.
It was at the very end, and they all begged off, so we'll probably try catching up with them by phone. They wanted to get out of there and get something to eat and something to drink and get on with the night. It was such a long program.
And Peter wanted to do that, too, and by the time Peter had packed up all the equipment, the crowd was so large you couldn't get near anything. But fortunately, Peter had done a little bit of planning to make sure that the rest of our trip was just, shall we say, a little more elegant, sophisticated, and considerably more laid back. In the rest of the program, listeners, you're going to listen to two icons. First icon is a wine icon. And I think Aldo Sohm in the interview at Lambanda that we recorded just a couple of days after the Beards speak for itself. So here's Aldo. The room exploded in cheers at the Beard Awards on Monday night when Aldo Sohm was announced as Wine Service Award winner, James Beard Award winner for the year 2009. Aldo, you must have had quite a lot of friends there.
Well, I thought I don't have as many friends, but it turned out that we have many friends there, yeah.
Well, so they're appreciators.
So you were really excited, right?
Oh, it's very hard to describe that in words, what I felt there and what I still feel, you know. It's kind of amazing how people come up to me right now and impressive what happened, you know, within the last years when I came to the U.S.
Well, you've had a long journey and...
Yeah, so let's go back to the beginning of the journey. We found out before we came on the air that Aldo was raised in Austria, and he liked to drink Bacardi and Coke as a teenager.
Yeah,
instead of wine, but the journey began through someone very close to you.
Yes, with my father actually, which asked me, "What do you want to do?" And I said, "I want to be a chef." And I wanted to work in the kitchen right away, but he said, well, look, son, you should go to a tourism high school because you have a little bit more opportunities than in case you don't like it in the kitchen. So you should consider that. And I followed his advice. And at that time, of course, I didn't like wine at all, but we went then to Alto Adige, to the northern part of Italy, and I saw how interesting that was.
For people who are not so so good on their geography, it's on the border of Austria and Italy, and was part of the Austrian Empire for a very long time.
It used to be
a very Austrian-influenced area of the world, where the wines are mostly white and some of them are sparkly.
Yeah, well, you find more whites and even very light red wines there. And funny enough, I started learning about wines, not about, with Austrian wine, I started learning with Italian wine. Don't ask me why that was kind of coincidental.
Well, you said then you moved to Italy because you wanted to work on language skills.
Yes, I was very close. I did my sommelier diploma also quite late. I did it in 1998 because the language skills was more important to me.
But you needed the language because all of the testing is different.
The testing was there, but at that time the testing was not there. It was more that, you know, we in Europe, we have multiple nationalities too, but everything is very close. So meaning we have, when you work in a restaurant industry, you're constantly involved with different languages. So in order to satisfy our Italian clients, I studied Italian language in order to get better there.
Now, you said you were in Florence and you discovered Chianti and you found out that you could tell the differences between the different kinds.
Yeah, I mean, I took the opportunity and took the chance once you're there, you know, and once you have direct access to that. In Florence, you know, it's quite a similar climate than here in New York, you know. It's in the summer especially quite muggy and hot.
Oh, yeah.
So I always drove up to Fiesole, which is a little bit above on the hill. You get always a slightly cool mist from the sea. And, yeah. A lot of students were up there and had drank also wine, but out of a paper cup. We had our Riedel glasses and tasted up there the wines from each individual village in order to get the differences out. So I took that opportunity on the evening. During the day, we studied Italian.
When do you think it dawned on you that you had some kind of taste bud thing that allowed you to really identify the finer distinctions between different wine flavors?
Well, I think I had a mentor there at my sommelier diploma, who actually was a competitor for the Austrian world, for the Austrian candidate as a on the world championship in 1998. He said to me, "You will be the perfect guy, you know, to enter competitions." And he initially I followed him and I watched the finals at the competition there. And tell you the truth, after that, I said, that's insane. I will never, ever do that.
Really? No,
yes.
What? Why?
Because the tension, the nervosity, the pressure what these guys have up there, it was crazy. And, yeah, well, never say never. A year later, I entered my first competition, and I ended up right second. So was
that,
a very good start.
That wasn't good enough, right? You were second again next year, and that still wasn't good enough.
You know, I'm very eager.
He seems like such a nice, laid-back young man. inside of that, there's a real competitor coming out.
Yes. Last year, I got a write-up, and someone said that I'm a competition addict. But I don't want to say that. But you know, it was an adventure. It was almost a trip for me to go through that and see how I grew. And it's also interesting because you see it from to yourself, you know, how you operate. So it was fairly simple from today's perspective.
Now, you have all kinds of titles. Your overall one, which you held for a long time, was best sommelier in the world, right?
I won that last year, yeah, because I competed then also when I came in 2004 to the U.S. The reason why I came to the U.S. was every competition is held in a foreign language, and I picked always English, but it was not good enough. So that's the reason why I moved to the U.S. to get my English really fluent and get a little bit rid of my accent. But I figured Americans love accents, so I kept it still a little bit. But
yeah,
the main
reason knows that, yeah.
The main reason was not to get that skill done. And in 2007, I entered also then the Best Sommelier in America competition, which I won. That enabled me to represent the U.S. for some reason. I won that. That's kind of Murphy's Law. I never won it for Austria. I won it for the U.S.
and at that point, you were sort of noticed. So, Eric and Maggie came calling and said, we need you.
Not directly that way, but it kind of... We got close together, and it was actually good in 2007. After I won the Best Sommelier in America, they reached out to me, and it was fantastic. It was a good. It's a very, very good fit. I feel very comfortable here. Of course, many people were surprised that an Austrian sommelier walks into a very, very French-focused place. But you know, as you know, we Austrians brought the croissants to the French people.
Yeah, I did.
What was it about Lebenada, that you said this is a wonderful, this is the next step. I mean, I think I can guess what it is, but
Of course, everyone says because of their reputation, but you know, you have to look a little bit on a bigger scale. That I worked for at Valse, my previous restaurant, when I came here to the US for 3 years. It was, I had a great time, but I knew also, you know, life is moving on. I achieved very much already at that time, and I was ready to go into a bigger operation. And then actually, you know, Lebrandt was, I got multiple offers, but I thought Lebrandt is a very, very good fit for me, especially because those competitions are constantly in a very high level. So it was, it made sense, you know.
But, well, from the wine list or the customers or?
And generally speaking, everything, you know. I'm a person who don't want to narrow myself completely down, because you have to have a focus, you have to have a goal. But you have to leave yourself a little bit room, you know, for flexibility, because things might come a little bit different.
So, you know, Peter raves about you. I mean, that's what he remembers most about all our meals, you know, is you.
Well, the wine pairing, well, I don't know whether Aldo did the wine pairings, but there's something we have to notice here, that this is not just a one person. The award won on Monday evening was for wine service, for service in the restaurant as a whole. So it's not just about Aldo Sohm, the brilliant taster and spotter of wines. It's much more than that. It's about, you know, a whole program and how you train all the people who are out on the floor.
Well, tell you the truth, the first thing what I did yesterday when all my sommeliers were together, I sat down and said, thank you, guys.
Uh-huh.
I said, of course, all the attention comes right now to me, but it's just a mirror for our team.
Right.
And then in the big lineup, I thanked also the complete floor staff, because, again, without them, I'm nothing.
And tell me what it takes to be a top sommelier.
Well,
is it your taste? Is it your memory? What is it?
It's a mixture. Of course, I studied a lot. You know, you have to combine theoretical knowledge with a very high chance, you know, to taste, and you have to combine that, and even the memorization of the flavors, of the characteristics. But on the other hand, you know, it's not only about the tasting skills and how much you know, it's also about how you were able to interact with people. You know, for me, it's always one thing is most enjoyable for me, to get with someone comes in at Le Bernardin for the first time in a 3-Michelin-star restaurant, and most of these people, they feel intimidated and they feel insecure. For me, it's nothing more enjoyable that when they come then to this to the table and open the wine list with 50 pages, you know, it's over for them. And you see that. But nothing makes more fun and nothing is more pleasure for me to go there and help and say, look, just relax. We're going to find a wine which you will like in your price range where you're still very, very comfortable in. And we're going to have a great time.
Oh, see, that's wonderful.
And we always have listeners, and we are going to again today at lunchtime, which is going to shortly follow our interview. But this is a very French restaurant in terms of the food, and the wine list is predominantly French also.
Yeah, very much so, and I kept it that way. Of course, we have some Austrian wines, but I mean they go also very well with our food. But I keep really the focus on French wine.
Now, a lot of people say that one of the flaws of California wine, there are some great wines in California, but that they tend to dominate the food. Would you say that, and that somehow French wines seem to be styled better to go with food?
That's a very complex question to answer that. If you don't mind, I will answer it differently. In a wine pairing is always one of, as I see it that way, a wine pairing is kind of, you know, that you bring the wine, match the wine with the food, so it works with each other. But a harmonious pairing is if, you know, there has to come a kickback from the food too. It's not only that the wine works with the food. It's like I compared always with a relationship. Someone only gives and the other one only takes. It's not going to last that long. And I don't want to talk myself into trouble right now. But,
I think it has to
come a kickback. Yeah. So, and that's the point. So Californian wine, generally speaking, or American wine, they can be quite good, but you have to have the right food with that.
Okay. It's funny, Evan. You must know Evan Goldstein.
Of course. Who doesn't know Evan?
Who's an old and dear friend, and he wrote a book together with his mother, who's a well-known chef and food writer, Joyce Goldstein. And they did the opposite to what was usual. So Evan picked some wines, and then
Joyce
said, "Mom, do a recipe that matches this wine," which is a very interesting viewpoint. Do people sometimes approach it that way?
They do. I have the tea, and there is no problem for me. Look, if you know the other way, you know, that's kind of makes a sommelier too. You know, you have to be versatile. You have to be flexible on that. Of course, here and there, you have to make a little compromises, but then you have to be honest and say that too.
Now, chefs have styles. Do sommeliers have styles? What is your style?
My style, I prefer a little bit more mineral-driven wines. I don't like wines which are heavy oaked, nor very high in alcohol. I don't think that's the ultimate goal. And I prefer wines where you feel good after a meal. For me as a sommelier, I can't afford to get drunk. You just can't. And if I drink a bottle of wine, you know, with 15-16% with my wife, well, I feel tipsy, and then I can't work anymore.
although you could do that on a day off.
Still, you know, I'm very, very disciplined when it comes on alcohol.
I'm sure you are. Now, what are some of, I mean, everybody knows the top French, the top five, the five growths of Bordeaux and the Grey Burgundies. Do you have some favorites that are perhaps not Domaine Romani Conti or Chateau Lafite?
I do very much, actually. There's a misconception, but I get this question very often. People believe always, you know, the more famous a sommelier might get, and I do consider myself even famous. I drink wines for $10 too, and I enjoy them very much. Of course, you enjoy a Romani Conti without a doubt, because there's so much history and everything involved into that. But at home, you know, I wish I could afford them every day. You know? But
so for you, the price, the prize isn't a top five Bordeaux.
No.
It's a wine find.
I have to open a Ponzi scheme for that first.
I mean, do you have a region that you think is particularly good
changing,
right now?
It's tell you the truth. It's kind of a mood for me. Lately, I admire very much Chablis. I'm, since a couple of weeks, heavy on that. But generally speaking, I love Rieslings very much. Again, more the mineral focused. And what I also like very much is red Burgundy. I'm dying for that.
You're dying for red Burgundy.
That's for me.
So you must have to shop very hard for bargains.
No, actually, you find really good deals these days. You know, of course, you have to look, but you get interesting small little Pinot Noirs out of Burgundy in retail stores for $25. So
I just read a book called Au Revoir to All That, which is really its premise is that food, wine, and culture in France is heading down the tubes. And part of the reason is too many people get the DOC. And they go for the popular, I mean, getting as many people into the program as possible. And so that there's no real reward for the people at the very top making wine in France. And also, the French have stopped drinking much wine.
Yeah, given a little bit by President Sarkozy.
Yeah.
And the alcohol controls, especially on the streets. You know, people are afraid to drive. And that's also my point. You know, you can't afford really to get drunk these days.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of very, very hard.
Now, give us a couple of stories. There must be a lot of stories in your life. Things that have happened. You were telling us before we came on air that somebody wanted to have a Chateau 76 Chateau Lafite with the calamari. just a couple more.
Fried calamari.
Just a couple more stories like that.
You want to know the same story, or you?
No, there must be literally.
Oh, there are. I mean, that was for me a good story because it changed a little bit my perspective, you know, because you can't. For me personally, I don't criticize people. That there's no point in that, because that's not my role. You can't tell people what tastes and what doesn't taste because that's a subjective thing. If someone doesn't like spinach must be bad, you know. That's the perfect example for that. So there are many, but, you know, to bring one down is kind of tough.
Okay, well, we'll move on to the next one then. If you were, Decanter magazine asks this question of wine, people with big wine cellars. If you could take only one bottle, I suppose you were marooned on a desert island and you could only have one bottle of wine, what would it be?
Oh.
Well, we let you have
That's
two.
That's a hard one, no.
We'll let you have two if you like.
No, I can tell that pretty quickly. It would be Riesling at Trockenbergnauslese, 76 from the Moselle, from Christopher Prüm.
Now, which side of the hill was it?
It's side of the hills at the Grapes Grove. It's Wilnesonnenur. I had this wine once, and the wine was just fantastic.
You only had it once?
Once, yeah.
But you remember?
But I have one at home in my cellar.
Okay. So,
does your wife like wine, too?
Yes. She is not as knowledgeable, but her palate became quite good because she tastes all the time with me. So she tells me exactly what she likes and what she doesn't.
Now, there's all kinds of elements of wine service beyond just knowing what the wines are like. So when someone joins your team, what are the two or three things you tell them that you think are most important for them to be successful?
Grounded, being humble. That's number one. And I live that also. You don't have to tell them what you do. You have to live that, you know. It's like, you know, when you tell them they have to do something and you do right the opposite, people don't credit you for that. You're not going to get build up a reputation neither. And they're not going to follow you with that. So I personally tell them, you know, to be humble, to be modest, to be passionate, and you have to love what you do. Otherwise, there's no point.
And you're still passionate after all this time?
Well, I think you can see it here.
Yeah, I know.
No, when I talk about wine, you know, that's and being in a restaurant, that's for me beautiful.
I mean, conservatively, have you ever thought how many different wines I've drunk already?
No.
There must be tens of thousands.
Possibly, yeah.
And he can sort out one of those. So I bet you remember almost every one, don't you?
I wish not. My brain is not that good, although it's kind of trained, yeah.
Yes,
great. Right, well, it was a delight to talk to you once again. Many congratulations on the award, which is recognition from people throughout the food and beverage industry that Aldo Sohm indeed for this year, 2009, was the winner for Best Wine Service. I think listeners, having listened to this conversation, you understand something about why, and you'll want to come to Le Bernardin and experience what it's like with Aldo or one of his team. And we're about to go do that, because we're going to have a little lunch before we go home to Pittsburgh. A last thought for our listeners, Aldo?
Well, enjoy the wine, even though in economy situations like that, I did one thing when last year, when, you know, the thunder clouds came up. I thought, you know what, we have to stay positive, regardless what we might hear, what we might read, because the more you think negative, the more you attract it also. I still stay positive, so, and I think life is also very good to you, and can be good to you.
Well, I think the U.S. feels lucky. We feel lucky to have you competing on our behalf. I'm sure you're going to win Best Sommelier in the World again and numerous awards.
No, it's over. I retired.
Oh, you retired.
I retired.
Oh, you can't
I'm only 30. I'm going to turn 38 soon, but I retired.
He's going to turn 38 soon. What a terrible thing. But you're going to stay a sommelier. What do you do after this? The answer is you do it for another year or another year?
I got a couple phone calls already. If people are smiling and laughing and saying, what is left over for you to win? I was very lucky and very fortunate, you know, that to fall into that path. I can promise you one thing. I will stay sommelier for quite a while. And I plan also to stay at Le Bernardin because it's a great family to be in with. And I feel it's like my family. And yeah, that's
wonderful. Well, yeah. Thank you so much for taking the time to
talk
to us.
Thanks, Aldo. Following this wonderful interview with Aldo, we also had an extraordinary lunch at Le Bernardin, and he personally paired up the wines to go with our tasting menu. Really surprising. Well, for example, we had smoked salmon and caviar, and the beverage of choice was that was a really, really fine sake, and it was just, it was fabulous.
And some of the pairings, some of the pairings were a little more conventional because guess what? We had a fine Pauillac Bordeaux with the meat course at the end.
Yes.
So there. Almost forgot, it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are again. You said, Peter, iconic. I mean, I guess you were skirting around an issue of this next interview. The restaurant itself is Le Cirque. How much more iconic can you get than that? In gorgeous contemporary digs. I mean, it's just so sophisticated and beautiful with smooth service. But we got to interview their new chef, who turns out to be actually a young Australian. Now, that's a surprise.
And a very unusual choice, and we recorded this before we ate. I can tell you, we won't save it till the end. Craig Hobson produced a meal for us that was absolutely delicious. So if Aldo Sohm was an award winner at the James Beard Awards, watch out for Craig Hobson. He's going to be one, I think, the future.
Absolutely.
So let's listen to what he had to say. Such a down-to-earth personality and such a wonderful chef.
On the Menu has obviously a very fond little spot in our hearts for Australia and Oz chefs in particular.
Oh, really?
But I never expected to encounter one in Le Cirque in New York City. But here we are talking to Greg Hobson, who hails from...
I'm from Geraldton. It's just near Perth in Western Australia.
Yeah. Tell us just a little bit about how did you get from Perth to New York?
Well, I started cooking when I was, 16 years old, and I always wanted to be in the biggest and best place. So, that led me from Perth to over to Queensland, Australia, then down to Sydney, Australia, which is bigger again. And
Where did you work in Sydney?
The restaurant was called Gecko. It's a restaurant back in the day. It's not there anymore.
No.
But it was one of these first of the contemporary Australian cuisine restaurants.
So you're mod Oz in your background.
Well, I've always worked with French chefs. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, I've always learned the French technique and being with French chefs.
Anyhow, so there you were in Sydney,
right.
But you jumped the big pond to...
Yeah, then I spent a year in Geneva in Switzerland, a year in Paris as well. And, that's kind of really immersed in French cooking right there.
Yeah, and you actually worked for some really hot talent in Paris.
Well, the best experience was at Le Carton with Alain Sonneras, and really a good insight into not only classical French cuisine, but using other exotic flavors as well. He's a real pioneer when it comes to... I mean, he was the first one to do lobster with vanilla sauce.
He was
the first one to use some Thai spices or Indian spices in French cuisine. So it's a real insight on how to spice it up or make it exciting.
And then you went from France to...
France
is all, by the way, listeners, in a 10-year period, so he's really moved.
Uh-huh. So back to Australia from France. I spent another year and a half there. I worked in a restaurant in Brisbane, Australia.
Oh, yeah, what was that?
It's a restaurant called...
Well, we don't have to talk about
Circa
that
in Brisbane.
That's a good beach thing, do you surf?
Yeah. No, it's Brisbane isn't near the beach. It's about an hour away from the Gold Coast, which is surfer's paradise, which is where all the waves are. But Brisbane itself is not near the beach.
Yeah, but it's close enough.
Close in here.
Good climate, hot.
Yeah,
hot.
Yeah.
And so then, how did you decide to just?
Well, I've always wanted to come to America and work here because it's. And I had a friend who was working for the Ritz-Carlton Hotels, and he moved down to open the one in New Orleans. And,
oh, wonderful.
Yeah, so you got me the job in New Orleans working with him.
Oh, so you cooked in New Orleans, too.
Mm-hmm. I spent about a year down there.
Wasn't that amazing?
Yeah, it's really a lot of food culture down there, and they have a lot of traditions, a lot of traditional seasonings and stuff.
What kind of food did you cook there?
Well, I mean, again, that was contemporary French food.
Where
I was working. At the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in a restaurant called Victor's.
Right, on the bottom of Canal Street.
Between the border of Canal and the French Quarter. But, I mean, the best food down there is the like the street food, if you like. I mean, the po' boys or the fried shrimp or that kind of stuff. It's not really the fine dining food. It's not that outstanding, but the street food is the one to look out for down there.
So you like that, I bet, huh?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then?
And then Philadelphia for a year.
Really?
Yeah.
Where there?
At the Ritz-Carlton Hotel there.
Oh, that's right. We have a Ritz.
And
there.
Then to New York. I spent 6 months at Artisanal with Terrence Brennan.
Oh, yeah.
And then over to his restaurant, Picheline. He's a chef at Picheline. That's where I spent the next 4.5 years.
Well, I mean, you sure hit the big time with all the restaurants you worked in. I mean, you're now executive chef.
Executive chef, yeah.
Of Le Cirque, which is like is about as iconic as you can get.
It is.
So why did you?
It's a real pleasure to be here. Oh well, I mean, it's an iconic restaurant, like you said. The prestige here is it's a famous restaurant, so it's a real honor to be working here.
But now, what about? I mean, they have a lot of classics you have to execute. Mm. How much freedom do you have cooking?
I have a good amount of freedom. We have classics on the menu, which don't change. Stuff like the Flounder Le Cirque, the Dover Soles, all that stuff never changes. But that's a lot of stuff off the menu, so it's almost like a menu without a menu. And then, but on the actual dinner menu, it's quite a lot of my food. There's a good six appetizers, six entrees that are all mine. Well, the lamb, I take the saddle and I bone it out, and I use the skin of the lamb saddle with all the fat and roll it around so it becomes in a It's like a log, if you like. So it's roasted, and you get the good lamb flavor because you have
wonderful.
The fat and everything. And it's served with a red pepper and cumin puree, and goat's cheese with it as well.
Ooh! Now, so, do you like the flavor of American lamb, or
I use American lamb? Yes. There's a lot of Australian lamb here, but I find they're only kind of exporting the commodity lamb, if you like, from Australia. Uh-huh. Commodity American lamb, of course, but you have the opportunity here of getting like the small cooperative farmers and a real better quality, fresher product.
So do you have a good relationship with the farmers in this area?
I know quite a few farmers. You know, we use a whole network of purveyors that can source stuff through different farms, and I always try and use the local stuff where I can. I mean, I don't really see the point in importing stuff from other states if we have it right here.
Yeah. The Dan Barber just got the
he did,
chef.
Yep.
Yeah,
and he's really doing something unique there.
But I might as well finish that sentence with the James Beard Awards, which is
I was there.
Tell us, can you condense the history of Le Cirque? I mean, this is the third location.
This is the third location. It's been here about 3.5 years.
I mean, this place is famous for, like, the celebrity. Do you still get celebrities in here?
Yeah, quite often, yeah.
Movie
stars,
around.
Financial types, New York business people we have here on a regular basis, yeah.
I'm looking at photographs, though. You've got Andy Warhol, you've got Jackie O, you've got Henry Kissinger, you've got Richard Nixon, so you still
they've
get
all
that
been
kind
of, yeah yeah
yep
so for the most part.
Now this, as I said, the third location. The second location
was at the Palace Hotel,
which is gorgeous space.
Yes,
but that's now Gilt, and then this moved to this place. Tell us where we are.
We're at 59th Street and Lexington in the Bloomberg Building.
Isn't it an amazing building, huh?
It is. it covers the whole block of, we're between 58th and 59th, and we're between 3rd Avenue and Lexington. We're kind of in the middle of a building.
Yes.
It's really quite unique in New York.
Now this, I mean, I've not been in this building, but I remember the last building. And the last decor, which was really circus. This is really sophisticated. Tell us about the difference in this space from what it was and some of the special features like the wine
tower. We've toned down the circus theme. It's still...
You do circle now.
Well, if you look in the main dining room, we still have the tent-like features, and it's a curved wall, and just to sort of offset that, to make it still the circus, but it's a little bit toned down. The colors are more contemporary, and the space is more contemporary. It was a lot of hardwood and features that still make it timeless. And the main difference is it's a lot bigger space. Over where we're sitting now is what we call the bar. It's a bar, and we have the cafe area as well.
It's a smart bar. It's really attractive. Yeah, you'd like to hang out here.
Yep, we have a good crowd here. And a big feature is a more casual dining area, which is over here as well. Which, you know, we don't accept reservations. You can just walk in. And a lot more economical menu over here as well.
And what about this wine tower?
Yeah, it goes all the way up to the second story. So
you don't have angels like climbing it like
No, you can access it from this floor or the next floor up. No. It's a ladder, old fashioned.
An old fashioned ladder. Yeah. Well, it's an exciting space. It has a lot of energy about it.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, so you tell us a little bit about. You're going to do a tasting menu. Do you have any idea what you're going to serve us? And you want to talk a little bit about it?
Well, we have our regular 6-course tasting menu. So one of you is going to get that, and I'm going to give you 6 courses of other dishes as well.
That sounds like heaven.
Yeah.
Tell us more details.
Well, right now, I mean, spring is coming on. So we have spring items, like a spring pea soup. I have soft-shell crabs right now.
I love soft-shell crabs.
So what I do, I actually tempura batter them. And
yes,
I mean, the greatest thing about soft-shell crab is the crunchiness, you know. So I think tempura batter really highlights the crunchiness of those crabs.
Yeah, you working in New Orleans, I guess you got a lot of exposure to soft-shell crabs.
Yeah. Well, I mean, ours come from Maryland, you know, and they're really, it's really one of the unique things this time of year. It's only this time of year, and it's something you can't get anywhere else in the world.
Tell me if you could think of one thing. I don't want to pull this on you, but if you could think of something that you would like to think of as characteristic of your food, what would that be? It could be, tell us a dish, you could tell us an attitude, anything.
I want you to wake up tomorrow morning and remember what you ate.
Aha.
So often you go out for dinner and, you know, I can't remember what I had. So I want food to be exciting. I mean, I use classical French technique, but I don't want to be limited by, I want to put flavors in there or textures in there that are going to make you remember what you ate. Whether it's adding a little Asian sort of influence or adding some Indian spice or some cumin or some crunch, some different textures of the same product. You know, if I use peas, highlight it with a pea leaf salad and then puree as well. So, I mean, I can use the same sort of ingredient different ways to really make that ingredient stand out by itself.
Now, somebody gave me a bio on you and said in his spare time he likes to go to the movies and travel. So I guess I have to ask you, like, where do you like to travel?
I like traveling anywhere. Just this weekend I went to outside of Houston, Texas. Not that exotic destination, but it's nice to get to see somewhere new. So I'm happy wherever I'm going.
And what about movies? What do you look for?
I like movies that have meaning towards them. I mean, something that tells a story but really kind of has depths in it, and you can really relate to that story.
Anything going on now that we should pay attention to?
No, I haven't been to movies in quite some time.
Funny
you ask. Yeah.
Oh, dear. Anything else we should know before we venture into this?
I think that you can appreciate the Cirque. It has its classical aspects, but it's also a place that is accessible and right up there with any other fine restaurant in New York City. We're not stuck in a time warp here. It's really kind of evolved over the years and is something new.
We have to ask the question because Sirio is a legend. He's not sort of a legend. He's a legend in the restaurant business in New York. Now, he
he hired you. What kinds of questions did he ask you before he made the choice?
I interviewed with Ciro and Mauro Marco, two of the sons, general manager, a bunch of people. Ciro sat down and said, well, I'm just going to say a little something, then I'm going to go. I'll leave you to it. 45 minutes later, he's still talking. He likes to tell a story, Ciro.
So he tells stories.
He knows what he wants. He knows what customers want, and he wants you to reproduce that.
He's an amazing person.
Yes,
people
he is.
Person.
He's a very, very generous person.
Why do you think he picked you?
I think picked me because I know, like I said, I've always worked for French restaurants. French worked in France. He tells me he wants something classical. I can do that. But then I can also do more contemporary stuff as well. You know, I can listen to him and do what I like and also do what he likes.
And you can, I think you really represent a whole new face for this restaurant.
Right. I think I was a long shot. I'm a non-French chef, so I think it's a leap of faith I think he took, yeah?
I think so, yeah. But I mean, it seems to me you seem very capable of moving this restaurant forward, and I think your point is well taken. People coming to New York should consider this as not just an icon, but also as a with it contemporary place.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, it's not, I mean, we cater to our local clientele, but we also very, very, you know, we have a good younger clientele as well, that people can come here and have a good time. It's not a stuffy, over-pretentious French restaurant. It's always been about the fun.
It's always been about people, yeah.
That's what the Maccioni's want, is a lively, fun place. Ah. And that's what we do here.
Well, you go and have fun in the kitchen, because we're going to have fun eating.
Thank you.
I really enjoyed meeting you. I love Australian chefs.
Great.
Thanks a lot, Craig.
Thank you.
Well, we were going to actually list all the things we had to eat, but there were so many of them. He was so inventive. And each one is a classic in its own right, but also given a fantastic inventive twist, creative twist by him. And he's such a talent.
And two of the dishes that he talked about was the soft shell crab, which Anne, of course, absolutely drooled over. And later in the meal, you remember Chef Hobson talked about the boned out shoulder that he rolled and reconstructed, and we had that dish as well.
And
it was equally exquisite. So. All we can say, guys, is you got to go to La Bernarda, you got to go to Le Cirque.
I'd like to go tonight instead of having chicken on the grill.
Oh dear. Back to Peter's cooking and chicken on the grill. What can I tell you? Eat your heart out, listeners. The chicken will be good too. And in the meantime, between now and next week, we hope you'll have a wonderful week, and we'll be here in the same place, same time next week. We'll hope that you'll join us then.
Bye bye.